Hello, and welcome to the New Testament Setting Podcast. My name is Dr. Benjamin Browning, and as we get started, I would encourage you to like, share, and leave a review on this podcast. It helps the channel out. Also, you can purchase my book called Facing the Mob, Rome, the Crowd, and the New Testament. It really helps us out. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I'm going to be continuing the interview of Dr. Corey Barnes that we did in the last episode. I hope you enjoy. Let's move on to a different topic. That's a good general. So let's move on. I know you've been doing some work with Daniel chapter 7 and kind of how that so it's kind of on your mind how that maybe interacts with the New Testament. So I'm going to throw some Daniel questions at your way, and specifically around this idea of the Son of Man. So those who are used to studying the New Testament, we know that this is one of Jesus's preferred titles for himself, the Son of Man, the Son of Man. So when we look at that phrase, so first of all, what is the meaning of the phrase the Son of Man in the book of Daniel? And how is that different from its other usages in the Old Testament?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So let's start off by thinking about probably Ezekiel is going to be a really, good place to look at this. In Ezekiel, we see Son of Man used a lot of God referring to Ezekiel, and it is explicitly to emphasize Ezekiel's humanity. You know, hey, human one, we could even translate it that way. So that's what we see there. We see it in the Psalms. What is man that you are mindful of them? The Son of Man that you could take account of him, right? So in those instances in the Old Testament, we have Son of Man primarily functioning as a human one. And we need to understand that understanding of what Son of Man usually means creates the drama of Daniel 7, or part of the drama. So in Daniel 7, God gives Daniel a vision. We see these beasts rising up from the sea. And Ben, you and I have talked about this before, Son of Man. There's so much there. If you look at ancient Near Eastern context and some of those things. But what we see is the Ancient of Days defeating these beasts that rise up to mock the authority of God. That's huge, by the way, if you're in Daniel's situation, that you and the people are captive in Babylon. It looks like pagan kings are in control. But now God is given a vision where he says, no, the Ancient of Days is in control over all things. He might let these beasts rise up, but the day is going to come where he judges them. And then the Son of Man shows up. And what we're told is that the one like a Son of Man is at the right hand of the Ancient of Days. And then the Ancient of Days gives him dominion. Now, we need to understand that people who first are hearing Daniel's vision, they're going to say a human one shows up. Like God's going to give dominion to a human one, like, or one like a human one, right? So in other words, that's who he's going to give dominion to. Well, what this means is that people realize, like, to one who is like a human, or one who is a human one, God is going to give dominion. That's the reason that when Jesus is in the New Testament, Jesus so often refers to himself as the Son of Man. Who is Jesus? He is the human one to whom God has given the authority to rule over all nations. And so what we see there through the Old Testament is we see early on, so Ezekiel, it's a human one. Daniel 7, in that vision, there's the expectation that there is going to be a human one to whom the Ancient of Days gives all authority. And then we come into the New Testament and it becomes clear for us why Jesus is calling himself the Son of Man, not a Son of Man, the Son of Man, the one to whom the Ancient of Days has given all authority. There's other stuff we could talk about there, Fourth Esdras and First and Second Enoch in intertestamental literature, which I saw, by the way, that you did a video on the intertestamental period. So I'll just tell your listeners that's, you know, there's a lot of value to going back and listening to what Ben's done there and listening at that. That's some of the literature that comes from this period. So there's more development there as this kind of gets combined in Jewish thought with messianic theology. But Jesus, when he claims that title, is saying, I am the one that the Ancient of Days has given all authority to. And so we see there just the profound claim to authority that Christ is making with that title.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that was kind of my next question is, in what way does it shed light? So you kind of already answered that. So, man, when we think about this Son of Man title, it's such a big title that he keeps using. So just kind of wrapping our head around this to kind of make sure we kind of summarize what you're saying. So you're saying that likely when when listeners would have heard Jesus say this.
Yeah.
When they would have heard this, likely this idea would have come to mind from the book of Daniel, of this is a figure who is like man, but maybe kind of, but he's not just an ordinary human being, who has a special connection with the Ancient of Days, with God the Father, right?
Right.
Is that's kind of the idea, that the connection they would have made.
It is, yeah. And I would say this too, man. I think that the I think that we reading, and I would encourage us to read scriptures theologically, right? Like mm-hmm. I don't think there is any value in us pretending when we read the Old Testament that we don't have the full revelation of the triune God. So I would encourage us to read the Old Testament as a revelation of the triune God. And here's why I say this. We look at what's happening in Daniel 7, and because of the clarification of the New Testament, we do need to see that part of what we have here is that this is, we see here the incarnation of the Son, right? Like that's what's happening. I don't think that's what readers understood in the Old Testament. We need additional New Testament clarification to see that. But what they understood is, I think what you're saying, that there's going to be a human one to whom God gives authority. Right. And that's the reason I think Jesus is saying that. He's saying, I am the human one. What we find as we read the New Testament, we see Old Testament passages that help create this expectation, is that he is the one who is fully human and fully divine. Right.
Right.
But yeah, I think that we do. I think we see that there. So I just want to say that to say there is there's more theology that we understand there because we read the scriptures theologically and understand the Old Testament in light of the triune nature of God. What Daniel's audience would have understood is pointing them towards that they don't have the fullness of that. So,
yeah. And you may not have the answer to this because I did not tell you I was going to ask this question. But as I'm thinking about the reality for the New Testament, which is that you have Jesus who is intentionally skirting around the fact that he's the Messiah early on. Yeah. Particularly because that brings with it all kinds of baggage in terms of rebel leaders who claim that title and kind of violent insurrectionism. So he's kind of skirting around that title, but he doesn't seem to skirt around Son of Man.
Right.
So when we look at Son of Man as used in the Old Testament, was that something that was seen as a messianic title or... Help me navigate that.
No, that's a really good question, man. I think let's define like what Messiah is in the Old Testament. But something we also have to understand is there's like the Old Testament understanding of Messiah. We do have to remember, and again, I think this is the reason it's helpful that you've talked about the intertestamental period. We have a period of time where theology continues to develop in Jewish thought. Okay. But in the Old Testament, I think that to call something like properly messianic in the Old Testament, we're actually looking for a particular word. We're looking for the word anointed one. Mashiach is the, and we see how we get Messiah. So Hebrew Mashiach, we would call it Messiah, Greek Christos, right? Like that's the, and here's the idea behind that. Think about the anointing of David in 1 Samuel. Okay, this is God's anointed king that God has had in it's Samuel in 1 Samuel that David is anointed. He's the king of the people of God. Fast forward now to 2 Samuel chapter 7. We have this expectation that one from the lineage of David is going to be the one who reigns over God's people forever. He's going to bring about shalom for God's people, rest for God's people. All right, that is at its core, that's what messianic theology in the Old Testament is. We would see it in places like Psalm 2, right? So in Psalm 2 begins with, you know, the nations mocking, right? Why do the nations rage? The peoples plot and feign. The kings of the earth set themselves and the ruler take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, right, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in heaven laughs, we're told. So God laughs and says, as for me, I have set my king in Zion, my holy hill. We see that expectation there, right? That the expectation, though we never see the reality fulfilled in the Old Testament, the expectation the Old Testament sets is through a king in David's line, God is going to anoint that king to lead God's people to be the people that God has called them to be, right? So that's messianic theology in the Old Testament. Now, I would say by the time we come to the New Testament, we have titles like Son of Man that have joined that messianic thought. Also passages like the scepter and the star passage from Numbers, right? We would see this in places like the Qumran literature, other intertestamental literature, where we see these various streams of thought like coming together in a messianic theology. We would have in reality messianic theologies in the New Testament, right, period, right? Meaning different groups of Jewish people have different expectations about what the Messiah is going to be. Here's what I think is essential. Think about Peter's reaction to Jesus when he combines two Old Testament expectations, blows his mind. What is Peter going to do when after the transfiguration, Jesus says, the Son of Man must go and suffer many things? What's Peter's response? He rebukes him. Because I think Peter thinks Jesus has his Old Testament expectations mixed up.
Yeah.
Like Jesus, no. The Son of Man is a conquering figure who has authority over all things.
Exactly, yeah.
The suffering one is different. And Jesus is showing us in the messianic theology that we should care about, which is actually the theology of the Messiah. And that is, what does Jesus say? That's going to be the same. It's through suffering that the Messiah is going to be elevated. It's through suffering that the victory is going to be established that actually brings God's people into all the expectations that God has had for his people. So I know that's an elaborate answer, man, and that might be more than we're looking for there. But that's what I would say. We've got to talk about, here's messianic theology in the Old Testament involves around God's anointed one. It's expanded in multiple ways through the intertestamental period. What should matter for us as Christians? What was the theology of the Messiah, which is where Jesus takes various titles and expectations and says, I'm fulfilling all of it.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's great. Like, I really appreciate you going through all that, because I think it gets to your point earlier where in the Old Testament, it's building expectation towards something. Yeah. Because what you have is you have these threads that are there, and he ties them all together.
Right.
And it's not exactly clear how those are going to be tied together until he does it.
Yeah.
Even to the people who are right there with him, immersed in this culture. That's extremely helpful. So with the little bit of time we have left, I know there's another topic from old to new that you're like really excited about. And that's the concept of Sabbath.
Yeah.
So with the little bit of time we have left, I just want to ask, and I'm going to kind of go off my formal script here a little bit to make it a little more condensed. Mm-hmm. What is the significance of the Sabbath in the Old Testament? And how do we see that affecting the New Testament and how Jesus interacts with it? So this is just kind of your catch-all, just tell us all you want to tell us about the Sabbath kind of question.
Yeah, man. So just to try to make this like really brief, Ben, let's just think about Genesis. Let's think about the Ten Commandments. And let's think about the ministry of Christ. Right. In Genesis, we need to see that God rests on the seventh day. We need to have an understanding that rest is not, it's not a rest born out of exhaustion, but it's a rest born out of fulfilled purpose. So now creation has been completed. So God ceases from his work. That's the word there is Shabbat. It's connected to the concept of Sabbath. It's on the seventh day. And we need to understand there that is every other day has had morning and has had evening, but the Sabbath day doesn't. The seventh day is presented to us in Genesis as the purpose for creation, is that God has created all things to live in this seventh-day relationship where creation rests in and enjoys God, and God rests in and enjoys creation. We start there. We go to Exodus 20. One of the things that I think tells us clearly that there's a connection to the seventh day in Genesis 7 and the Sabbath observance that we're commanded in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, the two Ten Commandment passages, is that Exodus 20 tells us that we're to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. For in 6 days, God made all things, and in the seventh day, he rested. So the keeping of the Sabbath then in among God's people is supposed to reference back to God's purpose for creation. And I would say that that informs the way that the Israelites were to celebrate Sabbath. And that is you cease from work, you enjoy the fruits of your labor and enjoy the fruits of the blessing that God has given you. It's important for us to note that it's not clear in the Old Testament that Sabbath is inherently tied to worship. That actually comes about in that intertestamental period as we move towards synagogues, right? Mm-hmm. But the original purpose for Sabbath has much more to do with rest and of trusting that God is the one who gives us what we need to enjoy that rest. And we see how that's connected to his work in creation. Then let's jump all the way forward to the teachings of Jesus. Jesus is often accused of breaking Sabbath law. It's one of the Pharisees' favorite things to level against him. And I want to make it clear, like the Pharisees are Sabbath keepers, right? But they're keeping Sabbath in a way that is as informed and likely more informed by the emergence of additional traditions. So what we would call extra biblical traditions. And we need to be fair. We don't give the Pharisees, we're unfair to the way that we treat the Pharisees, right?
Right.
Like we need to understand that a lot of us, you know, again, man, guys like you and I, that we want to dedicate our lives to the Lord. We try to go to church. We try to honor God and the things that we do. And we think these things are very important. The Pharisees were trying to do a lot of that,
right.
But they end up with these legalistic extra biblical practices. And in the case of the Sabbath, Jesus indicts them that their extra-biblical practices have violated the purpose of the Sabbath. And yeah. I would just encourage us to see this, that Jesus's claim about Sabbath was never the Sabbath is no longer necessary. But instead, his central claim about the Sabbath is that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.
Right.
So here's what I'm working on in some research right now, and I'm working towards a book on this. And that is, I think as Christians, we have dismissed the Sabbath as some type of ceremonial law that is somehow negated in the New Testament. I think that's a misreading of what Jesus says. I think it's also a misreading of passages like in Colossians, where Paul warns us against, you know, overburdening ourselves with the keeping of Sabbaths. I think there it's actually important that he uses it in the plural. I think what we need to see is that our King, so King Jesus, is the Lord of the Sabbath. And I think as God's people, we should be thinking through, okay, well, if Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath, if the Sabbath is meant for me to reflect upon God's work in creation, his purpose for creation and provision for my life, and if it's commanded in the Ten Commandments, which we would affirm all other nine commandments as things that we should continue to do as Christians, mm-hmm. shouldn't I give attention to keeping Sabbath? And I think the answer there should be yes. Doesn't mean we have to go back to other parts of church tradition and keep the Sabbath like the Puritans did, for example. When I started thinking of Sabbath, I thought about it from like Little House on the Prairie, where Laura Ingalls talked about how boring it was to sit in the cabin all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that we celebrate it in the same way that the Jews did in the first century. But I do think it means that we need intentional weekly time to rest in the provision that God has given us, to enjoy the fruit of the labor that God has blessed us with, and ultimately to enjoy God and reflect on the fact that God enjoys being with us, a union that he's restored through the gospel.
Yeah, I think that's something I think there's a need for a helpful correction in this area, because it's something that the church today, we so easily neglect. And then we're all like worn out and we're like super tired and we're overwhelmed all the time. And God has invited us to trust in him and to rest in him. I think the point you made about they're not being of the seventh day, they're not really being a, and not mentioning in Genesis the morning and the night. Mm-hmm. It just kind of ends with the seventh day and almost this sense of that's where we want to be. Like that's where we're working towards. That's a helpful, very interesting way to look at this.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of, like, for me, I'm thinking of all of the other kind of concepts. I'm thinking of Hebrews and the concept of rest in right. Hebrews and being able to ultimately get that rest. So yes, there's just so many places where this concept still intersects with the New Testament and with us as believers, but it is the commandment. It's the neglected commandment, the one that we kind of throw off.
Yeah.
And I think the Jesus's run-ins with the Pharisees have kind of maybe given us permission to do that, which he's correcting a different abuse, a different issue.
And correcting it in a way where he claims lordship over the Sabbath, right?
Right.
So not dismissing the Sabbath, but instead saying that this is so in the, you know, the kingly status of Christ places him in authority over the Sabbath. And I would say that those things that fall within the dominion of Christ are things that we as his subjects should honor.
Right.
And I will just say this, Ben, as far as how to do that, that's something that I am continuing to just try to place myself, you know, before the authority of the word and, you know, both in my practice of Sabbath, my family's practice of Sabbath, and now especially that I'm working on some things that will encourage others to be obedient to Sabbath. And just for your listeners, I don't think this has anything to do with Saturday versus Sunday worship.
Right.
And I don't even, I'm not at all confident that it's connected necessarily with our day of worship. But I am confident that there is a need to keep Sabbath in a way that honors the core commitment of Sabbath, which is I need to have something built into my life that connects my life with God's creative work. It's a proclamation that he is enough. And as you said, that this is my destiny. My destiny is to dwell with God forever.
Right.
And I think however we keep Sabbath, it needs to be connected to what God has done and is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, man, I really appreciate this. This has been a really helpful conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening to the New Testament Setting Podcast. I encourage you to share this with friends, to leave a review, and also to purchase my book, Facing the Mob, Rome, the Crowd, and the New Testament. It really helps the channel out.